Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I'm very excited to introduce our guests for the day, Nick Earls and Eric DiNicola. Thanks so much, you guys, for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yes. I'm really excited to get into everything that you're working on and, you know, how you got there. So everyone, Eric and Nick are with Winter Spring Capital. They are real estate investors focusing on multifamily. They purchase and syndicate large multifamily properties, and they develop luxury multifamily condominiums in the Boston market. And they also develop affordable housing and have experience with land entitlement. So really excited to get into your story. You guys, will you please start us off with telling us, you know, how you guys met and why you got into real estate?
Yeah, so Eric and I have been friends almost 20 years now. Met each other in high school. Did a lot of team-oriented activities together, football, powerlifting team, played competitive video games like World of Warcraft growing up. So good at teamwork from a young age, you know. So we had a good synergy, and we also kind of had like a bit of a rebellious streak to us that, you know, we don't want to work for someone else. And even from a young age, we didn't like school. You know, we were good students, but we were those kind of good students, you know, a little rebellious. So we had this idea, maybe we start our own company someday. Went to different colleges, but we kept in touch with each other. And I got my real estate license in 2011 and was selling smaller apartment buildings. And I said to Eric, maybe this is, you know, a way that we could kind of break out of the system and start something on our own. At the time, we were in our early 20s. We didn't have any money. So we just had this plan, maybe we'll buy a rental property in a couple of years, save up some money each year. And we were doing saving for maybe three or four years. I can't remember exactly at this point, but it was a couple of years we were saving. We'd saved up a good amount of money for us at the time anyways. And we saw an opportunity, not in a rental property, but in condominium development in the Boston market, which we can go into later on why that's such a good market for condominium development. But that's actually how we got started, was condominium development. We've been doing it ever since.
Okay. Awesome. Cool. Well, that's so great, you know, just to hear that you guys, you know, have known each other for so long and were friends for so long. I mean, what a cool partnership. And, you know, was there something about real estate in particular that kind of piqued your interest as far as, you know, not having to work for somebody else? Like, was there something that turned you onto it? Like, how did you get that bug?
I would say it wasn't necessarily the first thought where we said, you know, back in high school, we kind of talked about being entrepreneurs in some capacity. It wasn't necessarily, oh yeah, okay, real estate's the way, but kind of all roads sort of led there. I mean, it kind of fit our personalities well. We liked the idea of passive income. Nick had a background in construction, and you know, his parents owned a general contracting company. Then he was familiar with that, and he can talk a bit about that. So he kind of had knowledge of the nuts and bolts of construction. I had carpentry in my family, so I was sort of used to that. And then, you know, I went to school originally for engineering, but then switched into finance. And so kind of all these paths led us to decide, okay, look, we want to be entrepreneurs. We want passive income. We want to have security for our families later in life and not, you know, when we're 70. That point. And it kind of gave us the idea that this is the way to do it. I mean, we're going to be building up an asset base. We'll have a balance sheet. We'll be able to provide housing for people. And we'll collect mostly passive income kind of once we set up a system where we have, you know, professionals managing certain aspects of it sort of underneath us within the system that we create. So anyway, a long way of saying no, wasn't necessarily, okay, real estate's the way, but it kind of led to that.
For sure. Yeah, totally. It makes a lot of sense. And, you know, it is kind of a common story or theme, I would say, is that all these different pieces, freedom, being able to decouple your time from your income, being able to build wealth, not just trade your time for money, and also develop passive income. And then, of course, you have to have the right personality as well to be willing to kind of take on everything that we take on in real estate. So very cool.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I would actually love to just, you know, you mentioned, Nick, the condos in Boston. And, you know, I'd love to hear that story of how that happened and, you know, why Boston is such a great place for condos.
Yeah. So Boston, as most people know, you've got Harvard and MIT and a really strong university educational system here. Kind of over the past 10, 15 years, that backbone has been built on top of with the life sciences industry. Just to name, you know, a prominent example nowadays, Moderna, one of the vaccine producers, is headquartered in Cambridge, right outside of Boston. You've got a huge biotech presence, and this is in Boston itself, but also in the surrounding suburbs of Boston. So these jobs are very high paying. So you've seen basically, prices have been rising every year for the past 10 years plus now. And the zoning code in Boston is very restrictive, which leads to not enough housing being built every year as the demand continues to increase. And the demand is increasing from people with a high salary, which gives more room for prices to grow. Now, a lot of those people want to rent, but a lot of them with a high salary, they want to be homeowners. But they want to live in an urban environment. They want to have urban amenities. So there's a strong demand for condominiums, luxury condominiums in Boston. And there's a couple really good neighborhoods for them. Different neighborhoods will have different prices. There's some more premier luxury neighborhoods, and then there's some more kind of up and coming neighborhoods. And we've done projects in pretty much most of those neighborhoods where condos are hot. But that's kind of the story behind it is, you've got a supply restriction through the zoning code, and developers like us, what we do is we go in and we entitle land, and it's a very political process. You need to go in and meet with the neighbors. You need to get approval from politicians. There's a lot that goes into it. It can take sometimes up to 2-3 years, depending on the size of the project, but that barrier to entry allows you to get really profitable projects if you're able to get through kind of all those hoops of fire you got to jump through.
Yeah, for sure. That, and just for the listeners who aren't familiar with that term entitlement, can you describe what that means and how you get it?
Yeah, so here we tend to just call it zoning. Basically, you'll have a zoning code. Every municipality will have one typically. I know Houston doesn't have zoning code, but they have some restrictions. There'll always be some kind of zoning wherever you're trying to build. And when you look at a project that's of a larger scale, typically you'll have to get some sort of special permission. It's not going to be allowed just by the letter of the law. It might be, but typically a larger project will need to go through some sort of government approval. Now, that process can vary tremendously depending on where you're building. Some places are very easy to get land entitled. Some places like Boston, it's very difficult. With the difficulty, though, you know, becomes an opportunity because not many projects are permitted. So if you know how to do it, it's a good system, but it's definitely hard to do and painful at times.
Yeah, for sure. You know, something came to mind as you were talking about these luxury condos is that you guys seem to focus both on affordable housing and then also this luxury housing. And why such kind of disparate paths?
You know, it's we got into kind of the luxury condo market first, just almost out of opportunity. That's what we saw. That's kind of what the market demanded. We've gotten more into affordable housing in the last year or so. We see a big part of the market kind of trending towards that. There's a real demand for it. There's a need. The prices in Boston are getting very high. And yeah, and you know, we're building some of those high-priced units. So it is kind of a dichotomy there. But I think, Nick, you could agree or disagree on this. But I think in Boston, there's not really much of a middle ground. It's either you know, the any new condo, any new construction that's going to be a home ownership unit, and it's not necessarily a rental, but a condo, they're going to be very nice. That's the people who are buying those. That's what they expect in Boston. And on the opposite end, to buy something in Boston, if you're just making a normal income, even not, we're not even talking really low. We're talking pretty much an average salary in Boston. It's very difficult to buy one of these condos. You need to be working in one of these jobs Nick was talking about, where you're, you know, work for a life sciences company or, you know, some of these other tech companies maybe that Boston has, some of VC backed companies where you're making high salary, good six figure high salary to afford some of these condos. So an average person wants to live in Boston, buy a unit in there. I mean, they can't spend $800,000-$900,000 necessarily. So there's price restrictions on these affordable units, which make it impossible to build and sell based on the forces of the free market. I mean, you couldn't do it without subsidy. So that's kind of where we said, okay, look, this is what the market demands. We have an expertise in this. We're making money. We have a profitable company. We're providing housing to one segment of the market, but there's another segment that's underserved that we see growing. So let's see if we can also get into this as well, use our expertise in terms of construction and logistics, but kind of change how we deal with the financing and the marketing component of that.
Yeah, for sure. Makes sense. And I mean, another thing that kind of comes to mind is just like the barriers to entry. Like it sounds like both with this luxury condominium development, you know, you have to have the skill in getting entitlement. And then when it comes to affordable housing, there's obviously a bunch that needs to come together and, you know, maybe some brain damage that happens along the way to get the project done. Yeah. So, you know, if you have kind of the grit and, you know, tenacity to be able to get through one of those difficult processes, then the other one might be also more attainable. So very cool. So what would you say is, you know, just for people who are thinking about maybe doing something like, let's just start with the condominiums in Boston, getting those, the zoning, the proper zoning, any recommendations, any things that you've learned and can share about that?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is your team. It doesn't, you know, you could be the greatest all-star player. You're going to need a team supporting you because everyone has their own specialty. And a lot of this is hyper-local. So when you're getting land entitled, and especially in a hard market like Boston, where there's a lot of barriers to entry, you need to have a really good zoning attorney. You need to have a really good architect, and a lot of times a local architect who has, you know, connections and a portfolio of projects he's built in the area. You're going to need, really your biggest hurdle is how to deal with all the neighborhood meetings and getting the support of politicians. And the all-star player there is your zoning attorney. And a lot of this is, they've seen projects, you know, over the years, and they know kind of the patterns and rhythms of this political process that you might not know. Whereas, you know, they'll say, okay, we have to defer until next month's meeting because everyone's too angry at you. And, you know, you're kind of like, well, I don't want to do that. I mean, sorry, taking too long. But they know. And, you know, we just had a project like this last year where we kept having to delay and defer and do all this stuff we didn't want to do. But eventually, through the advice of our team, especially our attorney, we were able to pick up enough support where we got a project approved in an area where other developers, they wouldn't touch it. And then, you know, that's all thanks to your team. You're not able to do it alone. Development in general, real estate in general, it's all about team building. That's one of the biggest lessons we've learned.
Yeah, for sure. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, every player plays an important role in getting the project across the finish line. What was it about that particular area that other developers wouldn't touch?
It was mainly the neighborhood and the local civic group. All the different kind of neighborhoods of Boston have, you know, their own, what we generally refer to as like a civic group. Sometimes they might even be called, you know, the East Boston Civic Association or something like that. And it's just anyone who lives within that neighborhood of East Boston can go to their weekly meetings. They discuss, you know, things like crime, or they might have a police officer come, you know, maybe there's a toy drive or something. There's all things like that. But over the last 5 to 10 years, what's really increased is the amount of time at these meetings spent on going over developers' projects, new housing projects. Sometimes there'll be a group from the city that's there and they're doing, you know, an affordable project and they'll present. And there'll usually be a lot less pushback. But when it comes to guys like us who go in with a private company, maybe we're just, you know, a smaller firm, they, you know, they come at you with their fangs usually, because the people who go to these meetings for that purpose typically are against development. If you get a notice, you know, in the mail for a 6-unit condo building going up down the street that you can't really even see from your house and you don't care, you're probably not going to go to a meeting, you know, or if you do and you go to those civic meetings, you're concerned about some of the other neighborhood things. So we find that is kind of a huge thing, and it's increased a lot more in these civic groups, and the people who kind of lead them and organize the groups, they'll take in letters from the neighbors and they'll kind of say, okay, this is the project, and they'll try to be neutral, but of course they're part of the neighborhood too usually. So that I think is the biggest reason why developers have had a tough time in that neighborhood. They just notoriously voted down every project, really, no matter what. It doesn't really matter if your architect really blended it in. We've had times where we had a 7-unit building, for example, that looked like a 2-family. Someone said at one neighborhood group, you know, why can't this one look like that 2-family you built? And we said, well, that's actually 7 units. So we do have, our architect has a skill of really blending it in, but it's kind of just based on the idea that they just don't want anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, construction noise, change, whatever it is, that's typically the biggest thing, is these kind of meetings with large neighborhood groups. Because you need that support when you ultimately go in front of the city's zoning board to get the approval for these zoning variances that you'll need to fully entitle this land and say, look, I know it's a 2-family zone, but I'm trying to build a 6-unit building. I need you to grant these variances. And if you have a whole neighborhood group against you, the zoning board of appeals might say, sorry, we're denying this. You know, so that's, they're just very outspoken against developers.
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-C-A-P.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that probably is a very common theme regarding development, just, you know, across the board in growing cities. And sure. Yeah. So what did you do to kind of gain the support of the neighborhood groups in this particular project?
You know, it's kind of weird, because that's why I was kind of mentioning, it's like the attorneys, they develop gut feelings over time, because I don't really know what we did. Like, there's some obvious things that we do in every project where we go in with an amount of units that we're not going overboard. We feel is an appropriate fit for the neighborhood, but we know we'll potentially get knocked down maybe a couple units when we go to those neighborhood meetings. We did that, but a lot of this time was we'd have a meeting and, you know, everyone would say, you know, you can't build that here. And then we'd say, okay, we can't go to the zoning hearing yet. We need to have more meetings, which, you know, obviously burns a hole in your pocket every time you do that. Then we just somehow over time, by continually deferring and just being kind of stubborn about it and really, really nice at all the meetings, our attorney's really nice. He knows all the neighbors because he's a former politician who was pretty prominent in the city. Speaking with him privately, getting to know people, you know, being really friendly, killing people with kindness. Eventually, we picked up support from a prominent politician because we agreed to donate something to like a fund she had for supporting people who couldn't afford rent in that neighborhood. And just little things like that, you kind of chip away at it over time. And it's hard to point to any one individual thing. It's about being really, really patient, I think, with some of these, because we've had certain projects where we do exactly the same thing as we did on this project, and it sails through approval in like 6 months with no opposition. And then we'll have a project like this in a tougher neighborhood, and it's just people are opposed to change. There's not really much rhyme or reason to it. So it's an emotional thing. It's almost like you're their counselor or psychologist or something. You know, you got to connect with them on an emotional level and make them realize you're not some evil person trying to ruin their neighborhood. You're trying to actually help, you know, supply units of housing, which can slow the rising costs that we've seen over the past 10 years.
Yeah, for sure. Very interesting. I mean, all these questions, I think, are they're sort of around these same themes, like, because, you know, neighbors are used to the way that their neighborhood is, and they don't necessarily want to see it become more busy, and they already got in at a certain price point, right? So it's not necessarily in their personal interest to see the neighborhood grow. So do you ever pitch it to them, like, in a, you know, a sort of more inclusive, more holistic way? Like, how do you appeal to them specifically?
Well, one thing we do try to do, because fundamentally, when you look at it, you know, we have a business, and of course, we're trying to make money as a business. There's not many businesses out there who are trying to lose money. But ultimately, the product we create does house people, and it creates homes for a family that wants to live in East Boston, or you know, Jamaica Plain, these different neighborhoods of Boston. So a lot of times, you know, right off the bat, you get opposition. They see maybe how much a unit sells for in the open market, and they think, oh, these guys are just taking all this money in their pockets, and they're so focused on the money and all this. And it's like, well, you know, there's a big cost to that building too. You maybe cost 95% of that price that we're selling it for, you know, but they've kind of forget the fundamental truth that we're actually, there's people who want to move to your neighborhood. You know, there's people who want to come to your city, pay more taxes, increase, you know, public funds available to do things, upgrade these roads, sidewalks that they'll complain, you know, maybe about at the same meetings, as an example.
Yeah.
So I think we try to say holistically, look, this is A, if you're worried about your property value, this is going to help increase it, because you're maybe showing, okay, there's a demand for developers to build here. If you ever want to sell your house, someone will definitely be there to buy it. But most importantly, you're bringing in these neighbors that I just spoke of. People want to move here. It's not just this building that's going up. This is to house people who want to be part of this community, who want to live here, want to contribute to the community, who want to be friends with the neighbors and work here. So that's, I think, the ultimate kind of like holistic way to look at it. It's not that we're just dropping a black box in the neighborhood. We're creating, you know, housing units that people wouldn't buy them if they didn't want to live there, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I really appreciate your perspective on that. It makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I mean, I think it takes a ton of skill to be able to win people over like that. So great work there.
We try. It's definitely a tough skill to learn.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I've definitely been through a similar process, you know, just on my own projects, but I didn't require the neighborhood support. It was just, you know, they were allowed to comment and whatnot. But, you know, it was already an allowed use, what I was trying to. So I wasn't going for a variance or anything like that. So to actually get people on your side when you need it is a whole nother thing. So I'd love to now just focus a little bit of, I wanted to ask you about construction costs and how, you know, I mean, obviously that's a hot topic these days. How are you guys, you know, wrapping that into your development pro formas?
Yeah, I mean, they've definitely risen quite a bit, and we just kind of have to budget for that. So right now we're seeing projects anywhere from $50 to $75 a square foot higher than they were 2-3 years ago.
Wow.
And
yeah, I mean, that's a lot. And just how can you, you know, make those numbers work? Is it just pricing has also increased that much?
That actually offsets it quite a bit, at least in Boston. That helps make up for it. Even over the past year, we've seen prices climb rapidly here, as they have in many parts of the country. But it doesn't make up for it fully, but it is somewhat of it kind of neutralizes the price increase somewhat. But I would say there's less projects that pencil overall. But if you go in knowing, you know, what the increased number is, then you underwrite with that in mind, and you just follow, you know, whatever your profit guidance is that your company follows. For us, we try to look for something that's making around 25 to 30% return on total development cost.
Mm-hmm. You mean for net to investors or for the project overall?
Project overall.
Okay. So I just want to get your guys' perspective on kind of holistically with, obviously, we have a shortage of housing in this country. You guys are builders, you're developers, and costs are going up. Pricing is going up. Like, do you feel like this is, I mean, how are we going to get enough housing built in this country, given the fact that, like, not only pricing for construction is going up, but also the cost of housing is going up? So people, it's not necessarily an attainable price. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, we do. It's right now, I think the zoning codes in a lot of these cities are just so outdated. A lot of them don't allow for multifamily housing. They don't allow for, you know, you need some of these cities outside the main city. You might need like our towns, you might need, you know, an acre just to build a single unit. Whereas when you're dealing with urban infill, the kind of the type of development projects we do in Boston, you could really fit, you know, 6, 7, 9 units, homeownership units on maybe 4 or 5,000 square feet. So, you know, you're talking an eighth, maybe a tenth of an acre, right? And you're getting 9 times the amount of families in there. So I think what is something we talk about a lot is lifting in a lot of these restrictions on zoning and kind of changing and really, you know, having municipalities go back and say, all right, when we made these zoning codes 50 years ago or 70 years ago, some of them, and, you know, some say, oh no, we've updated it recently. And that was like 1994 or something. They need to say, again, this is our opinion, but I think it kind of plays out pretty well. They need to just allow for more density. That's kind of, I think, going to be a big help. What you'll see then, you'll see more projects getting approved. You'll see prices a bit more attainable. You'll see a larger kind of mix of unit types and housing types available. And you'll probably see more competitive pricing in the construction industry as well, just because there'll be more competition, there'll be more customers. Because as we know, the end customer of all this, the home buyer, is lacking a supply to choose from.
Yeah, absolutely. And can you expand a little bit on what you mean by density, or specifically, you know, what kinds of density? I mean, I'm sure it's going to vary depending on the area, but can you just expand on that?
Yeah. So, I mean, a big thing is we need to be building more multifamily housing. If you'll take Massachusetts as an example, the vast majority of multifamily is in Boston or the cities that are directly abutting Boston that are also pretty dense, like Somerville or Everett or Chelsea. Once you start going out just a stone's throw out into the suburbs, it's like single families with sprawling, you know, like yards. And it's, we know zoning codes because we pretty much studied everyone in Massachusetts because we want to build multifamily, either condominiums or rentals. And we're, you know, we're doing some pretty larger mid-sized projects in Boston right now, but it'd be very hard to get those approved in the outlying communities. And when you're depending on the urban core for all the development and the urban core itself is restrictive and it's hard to get it approved, it's just a supply nightmare. I mean, we're never going to build enough. And this, I know Boston and Massachusetts is particularly strict, but from what I've read, it's a problem throughout the country. So if they would allow apartment buildings or even smaller like condominium buildings, like we build a lot of times, you know, 10, 20, 30 units, that will do a lot because we're talking about, you know, we're talking about the outlying communities of Boston. 100 plus municipalities. Like if each one of those allowed some multifamily to be built, that's tens of thousands of units of new housing. So that needs to be happening nationwide. And single family housing should be restricted heavily. It's not really helpful to anyone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. And do you see a pathway forward on that politically? Like what are the sort of actors that would need to kind of or have the best chance of sort of getting cities to change their zoning codes?
Well, here the state has taken action. They just passed a law that I'm sure will be challenged by the individual towns. But what the law says is you have to allow, and this is a new law, it's not fully implemented yet, but it'll hopefully have some nice effects in the upcoming years. If it's within, I believe, a half mile of a train stop. So we have the commuter rail system here. So transit oriented development, they have to allow multifamily of a certain level of density, certain amount of units per the size of the parcel that you're building on. Mm-hmm. That's sort of, and I was actually surprised. I was pretty happy to see that, both for the sake of our company, but also just a common sense solution. You know, everyone's talking about environmental change and we should be less reliant on cars. And then at the same time, the affordability crisis, this kind of checks all those boxes. You're transit oriented. So you're getting people on, you know, public transportation and you're building more housing, which can stop the rapid increase in prices that we're seeing.
Yeah, for sure. Very cool. Awesome. Would you give us an overview? I want to switch gears now and just talk about your affordable housing project. And just tell us a little bit about the origins of that and who you're needing to work with to get it forward and like what makes it qualify as affordable. Just a general overview.
Sure. Sure. So it's our first, the project we're currently working on now is actually our first one. We're working with the local municipality, which is Boston. They have varying types of what they call affordable projects, sort of different departments. We're working with the Department of Neighborhood Development. So sometimes they'll own these pieces of land, they'll be city owned, and they, you know, in our case, it's four parcels, and they had their own architect design the four structures that they want on these. Sometimes you might have just a parcel of land and your own architect would design it completely. So what happened with this process is they put out a request for proposal. All developers who are interested put in a proposal and say, okay, we know already you have the plans. This is what you want us to build. So, okay, we have that. You basically say, here's my team. Here's who I'd work with. Here's how much it would cost, which is the city's biggest thing. Here's how much, you know, we would charge as a firm, because you charge a fee as part of that. And the city basically looks at it and says, okay, who's the most competent developer here who can, you know, do the nicest product for the lowest price, I think. They don't say exactly that, but that's kind of how they come to it. So that's who we're working with, the Department of Neighborhood Development. We also have an architect who introduced this process to us, actually, who's done a lot of affordable housing projects with the city. He knows how they operate. So they really liked, his firm liked this project and said, look, you know, we don't have to even design anything for you. We'll come in, we'll look at the drawings, make sure everything, you know, checks the boxes. We'll kind of walk you through it. We'll help you create your proposal because we've seen how this works. So they helped us with that. And the city also, one of the requirements is all the, you know, the members of your team, they want a very diverse and inclusive group and all sort of Boston-based people who are live or work within the community. So they have a lot of kind of, you know, not necessarily requirements, but that's what they're looking for. They want you to give as many types of people and people from different backgrounds an opportunity to be part of this development, and also people within their community at the same time. So we kind of did all these things. We learned how it worked and we said, okay, you know, we can do it for this much. And they must have said, okay, look, you guys seem to be the most competent. You have the fairest price. We'll grant you, you know, the proposal you put in, we'll deem you guys the developer. You won the bid, essentially. So the question about what deems it as affordable is the city has, you know, income limits where they say, okay, this is an IDP restricted unit. It's part of their, what they call the inclusionary development policy. And they'll price it based on these different income limits. Same with rent too. If you're building a rental building, they'll price the rents based on those. And that essentially means this is what you can sell it for. So it doesn't matter if it costs you $500,000 to build this unit, construction cost, everything, you can only sell it for $250,000. So that's why no one would do these. No one would, you know, construct these projects and lose 50% every unit without a subsidy. So that's where the city comes in and says, look, we'll give you the difference so that you break even. And then you still say, okay, well, from a company standpoint, how does that make sense? You put all your resources, your people, your time and effort for a couple of years to break even. So that's where then you have a small fee that you can collect for your overhead and company operations as you go. And so that's how this entire process worked. They've deemed, okay, you have seven units you're building across four sites for our particular project. Six of them will be home ownership units that you can only sell based on these few AMI levels, the area median income. And then one of these seven units will be a rental that'll be rented. Once you're done, you won't own it. The city will be the landlord for that person. And it'll be rented at a rate that matches up with the income level that renter fits into. So that's kind of how it works. They have these set levels. They deem the price based on the applicant's income. And then there's just a maximum price that you can get up to. And you say to the city, okay, you want us to have six of these units at the 80% of the area median income. So we tell you exactly how much that would cost to build and sell those for. They make up the difference in a subsidy. And that's kind of, you know, I hope that kind of explained the process.
Yeah, for sure. I am curious if you know, I mean, I'm familiar with how rents are set. Maybe we can go over this for the listener's benefit. But as far as sales price, like how is that related to the area median income and how do they set that?
Yeah, so they use the area median income as well. I don't know how they exactly calculate it, but they'll have brackets. And a lot of times, you know, you might be doing a project and you'll say it's an affordable housing project, but most of the units are for someone with 100% of the area median income. So they're literally kind of the prototypical median average person that's living in that neighborhood, but it's still an affordable housing project. because of how, you know, expensive it is to actually buy a market rate unit. So you'll have different price brackets, and it's also divided into different neighborhoods because the median income varies from neighborhood to neighborhood. And that'll be updated every year. I think the city has a formula they use, but I don't know it off the top of my head.
Okay. Yeah. But just to, for the listeners' benefits, you know, there is an area median income based on, say, a four-person household, and then there are different levels of affordability. So it sounds like some units are priced at 100% of area median income, meaning the exact median. And then sometimes, you know, you take 80%. So you literally multiply 80% by the area median income, and that would be a 80% AMI unit. And I guess they somehow determine a price that is affordable, a sales price. Yeah. And then there's could be 60% and 50%, et cetera. Okay. Well, thank you so much, you guys, for coming on the show and just sharing so much of your, you know, experience getting these complicated projects through. Really enjoyed the conversation. Would you please take a moment to share with the listeners how they can learn more about you and your firm and what you're working on?
Yeah. Thanks for having us on. You can find out a lot about us on our website, winterspringcapital.com. Ton of good educational resources. We have articles. I wrote a book about the condo development strategy, winterspringcapital.com/development-book. We got a couple other investor guides on there. We're also active on Instagram at Winter Spring Capital. We post video updates of like jobs that we're building right now. And then Eric and I are both active on LinkedIn, Nick Earls and Eric Di Nicola.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, you guys, for coming on the show. Really enjoyed it. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.